Hi, and welcome to the Applied Medication Safety Podcast. We are kicking off Season 2 on anticoagulant safety. I am so happy about this first guest that we have. He is an emergency room physician with a special interest in direct oral anticoagulants, or DOACs, as you'll soon hear. And just a couple of tidbits for the first part of the second season. There's going to be a bit more medical terminology in this, so don't worry if you have to look a few things up. I'll try to forestall some of the questions that might be there. Alteplase, for example, is a thrombolytic drug, meaning it is a medication that dissolves clots. You're going to hear about some other medications, heparin, warfarin. Heparin is going to work on the clotting cascade. There's a couple of different arms. I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit more later. Warfarin is going to work on one of those arms, typically the ones that require vitamin K in order to be effective. But all that aside, we're going to throw all that up in the air and dive right into some practical applications of anticoagulant safety. And this is going to be part one because it was such an awesome conversation that we had to break this into two pieces. So get ready, strap yourselves in, and let's go. Welcome to the Applied Medication Safety Podcast once again. And I'm just so happy to be talking with an emergency room physician who has this special interest with direct oral anticoagulants, or DOACs, and certainly have a lot of background, so if you don't mind.
Absolutely. I've spent nearly 20 years in clinical emergency medicine, and my initial background was in what we term low-incident, high-impact patients, STEMIs, strokes, cardiac arrests, massive PEs, helping to operationalize those systems. And then when my hospital decided to look at discharging DVT patients outpatient on DOACs, we realized that same approach to risk management and building a stable approach was even more important because a number of these folks were going home and having problems.
You know, that sounds like a pretty progressive approach as well. Many times what I find in medicine is a root cause analysis, or the perhaps more technical term, whack-a-mole, which is a problem that we isolate the problem that has already happened and then implement solutions to prevent the problem that will likely never occur in that particular constellation once again. So the fact that you had an approach that is system-oriented is in itself rather fascinating. You know, could you elaborate a little more on that?
Well, the emergency department's chaos on top of chaos. You have rotating providers, you have people cycling in and out, you have patients that you do not really potentially understand their condition prior to arrival and then what's going to happen after arrival. And so within that chaos, if you want to deliver a precision outcome like grandma going well at home and not grandma gone bad, the system and the approach has to be really robust and standardized, but flexible enough that you can put in some small unit decision making. And discharging a patient home on DOACs is exactly one of those case studies where you can understand many of the anticipated pitfalls and engineer solutions into your process.
Oh, that's excellent. Well, would you mind walking through the grandma gone bad case with the experiences that you've had?
Sure, and I'll preserve anonymity in this. This case came about because I was talking with someone in an outpatient setting in a social situation, and we started to talk about what she did and what I did, and then she volunteered that she had just had swelling in her leg and that she was discharged home on some kind of blood thinner. And so I talked to her a little bit about that and shared my background in anticoagulation and emergency medicine, and ended up kind of learning more about her process. And basically, she was 78, she's a little old lady, very nice, has had some prior back surgery, walks with a limp, lives in a place with lots of steps, kind of far off the beaten path. And her neighbor noticed that she had a swollen leg. So she called her primary care provider, who said, go to the ER, where she got an ultrasound. And they said, you have a clot. And then they gave her a month of DOAC and sent her home to see her primary care physician. and she dutifully called her PCP. But then when she went to the pharmacy to get her second month of medicine, she found out that she would be personally responsible for the hundreds of dollars out of pocket because her insurance company did not cover that particular DOAC, and so forth and so on. So there was already a number of things building up because in this case, this lady had had several falls in the last 7 months. She had some bruises on her arms, but she had been discharged home on a DOAC with really, to her memory, for example, no education about fall. And she was beside herself because on her budget, the next month of DOAC was going to completely break her disposable income. And she couldn't answer me if she had a big clot, a little clot, an occlusive clot, or a non-occlusive clot. All she knew is that she needed to call her PCP, but she had been unable to reach them up until this point. And I guess I'll stop there because already you can see several patient risk problems brewing.
Yeah, absolutely. I often wonder if we'll get to the point where we can have a black box warning that says causes poverty.
Yes, and fragmentation of the healthcare system, because this was a very aware individual who just didn't understand anticoagulation risk benefit calculations and all the things that we need to provide guidance on.
So in your mind, when she's coming in and has that diagnosis, here's a clot, and the reason why treatment with an anticoagulant is going to be important, what do you think she's walking away with? That there's going to be a pill that dissolves the clot? Does she understand how the body manages homeostasis? Does she understand the risk of bumping her shin or having arms that look like old bananas just from bruises?
Well, those are great questions. And fortunately, I was able to kind of query her on all of those things because I did have some time to talk with her. And she was not aware of the risks of being on anticoagulation. When I talked to her about the risk of if you bump your head, you need to go to the ER because you can spring a little leak on an anticoagulant that will never seal. And then 2 days later, you're seizing and you have a head bleed. So she wasn't aware of anticoagulant risk. She wasn't aware that her medicines were risks to fall more. And she wasn't aware of exactly what the anticoagulant was doing. She did think that it was dissolving the clot. And I explained to her it was preventing further clot formation. So very good insights on your part.
So yeah, so much of safety when it comes to medication safety, it really is a partnership with the patient, because without a good patient understanding, they can't really be that partner and cooperate well to make the therapy as successful as possible. I once had a patient, just to give a quick story before we come back to Grandma Gone Bad, with warfarin, and it said take as directed, and it had number 90 pills on it. Well, this particular person had another medication that said TID, or three times daily, and it had number 90 on it. And so this person thought, well, naturally, well, if there's 90 pills, then I need to take one three times a day. And so they had taken warfarin 5 milligrams three times a day for a month and then came in for a refill. Oh. So that was quite unfortunate. We didn't give the refill for the warfarin. We did, however, give them a prescription for a vitamin K.
I bet they did.
After doing some blood testing as well. But it speaks to the incapacity even of the ability for other healthcare team members to assist in that. Because when what a pharmacist gets, and I'll just speak from the pharmacist perspective on that, you know, it's not unusual to have that description that says as directed. But if the pharmacist doesn't know what as directed is supposed to mean, it's very difficult to counsel that patient other than to say, well, don't you remember what the doctor told you? or what the anticoag lab told you. And so when you talk about fragmentation of healthcare, with warfarin, certainly there's that fragmentation that can occur just by virtue of the instructions and the monitoring. What kind of fragmentation do you also see with the DOACs?
Fragmentation with DOAC care is a tremendous problem that dwarfs what you see with warfarin for a number of reasons. One, paradoxically, because warfarin requires some serial tests and monitoring, people at least receive education. I'm on a blood thinner. It's that one I have to get checked every so often. They told me not to eat spinach. And so when you hear those keywords, you know they're on warfarin. There's no other descriptor out there that's warfarin. But also because they then have enough connectivity to get at least semi-regular INR test, they do have some connectivity with the healthcare system. So the extra burden of education and surveillance under warfarin actually means, in general, a patient has to be, they almost always can tell you that they're on some blood thinner that they need to get tested for. In contrast, I've commonly seen where people come into the ER at 4 a.m, they've got something like a swollen leg, and they go home on a DOAC, and the patient, their remembrance is, they gave me this medicine, said to take it once or twice a day, probably for 3 or 6 months, and I'm supposed to see my doctor. And they really can't tell you what it's on. It's just another pill in their pillbox with no special instructions. So it's very innocuous. It's just another one of those little blue pills that grandma takes. And then the problem on the other side is because, as you know, the half-life of Coumadin is longer. If someone forgets a Coumadin dose or two or three, they don't go from protected to unprotected in one day. And these DOACs, if the patient forgets one or two doses, they then can have periods where their VTE protection is gone until they remember that this is the one medicine that you can't ever skip. Because if you do and your clot enlarges and floats to your lung, DOAC noncompliance is actually a problem because there's no protective tail.
Right. That venous thromboembolism or can really, like you said, break off and travel and go to other places. Does that risk, do you think, diminish over time? Do you think that patients will have a sense that this is going to be really important in the first few weeks or the first month, but if I miss a dose after 3 months, that's really not that big a deal? What kind of impression do you think they have, and how do you think we as healthcare providers are best positioned to impress upon them the importance of that regimen?
Well, that's a great question. And I think in the acute phase, say if someone comes into the emergency department, targeted precision, simple education, repeated over and over till it's almost like multiplication tables is really important, because humans, we have to hear something at least 3 times in 3 different ways to hear 1/3 of it. So if the initial provider says, look, for the next month, you absolutely need to take this medicine every single day and never skip because this is the worst time for you. And then when you get to see your primary care provider in 3 to 4 weeks, they'll talk to you more about the medium and long-term outlook for you, because you may need to only be on this for a month or 3 months, but your provider might work with you and decide there's other risks where you might need to be on it longer term, like a blood pressure medicine. And so the emergent grades into the urgent, grades into the long-term outlook for DOACs. And that discussion up front with a new DOAC patient should be for that first month, you just have to take this every single day and don't forget. And if you do forget, then you need to have a plan to take a second dose with your first dose. And maybe you should set your cell phone at 6 a.m. every morning and have the DOAC's time. You know, so there's ways to engineer compliance. And with DOACs, that's critical because you're sending them home, presumably, to prevent a urgent diagnosis of DVT from turning into the emergent diagnosis of PE.
Yeah, nobody wants to see the pulmonary embolus come through, unfortunately.
you don't. And we have anecdotally started to see, and I've seen a number of cases in my career where people come in PEA arrest, ultimately with massive pulmonary embolism, and you see in their history that they had been diagnosed with VTE risk factors or had a prior VTE, and then for some reason they became non-compliant with their, or intermittently compliant with their DOAC. And whether that was finances or boredom or lack of awareness, it doesn't matter in the end because they all were, you know, they all died.
Yeah. So, I mean, the risk of the clot is certainly attendant on the non-adherence, the non-compliance, which is a lot more sensitive, I guess, than the warfarin that has that longer duration of effect, where it's going to be fewer highs and sharper highs and lows, basically, with that. But looking at the other side of that, I mean, at least with warfarin, you can do a blood test and see what the INR is, and if it's elevated, that they're at high risk for bleeding. When you're dealing with DOACs and you do have somebody who's taking it every single day, then what kind of guardrails do we have on the upper end to protect or to signal a concern for bleeding?
Well, that is a blessing and a curse of DOACs. One is that DOACs do have a large safety margin, and there are very few pharmacokinetic issues in the body that will cause you to build up toxic levels of DOACs. But at the same time, we don't have an assay that measures current factor 10A activity like we do with warfarin. And so our understanding is that in most, almost every patient that has proper, reasonably good liver and kidney function, if they're taking a standard DOAC dose as prescribed, they're extremely unlikely to launch into some toxic level. And if they did, then simply withholding that DOAC for a day or two would let it go back down to its baseline. Over the last 4 or 5 years, there is a DOAC antidote called andexanet alpha, which is a biomolecule that more and more large emergency departments in emergency medicine are holding on site. So there is a antidote to what I call DOAC toxicity if you come in and you have a bleed, for example. So if you put all that together, DOACs can be very safe, but if you start to pull away the monitoring that warfarin intrinsically requires and you get a more cavalier attitude about the risks of DOACs, then noncompliance and cost and boredom become more and more the problem.
So you mentioned the andexanet alpha, and that actually has been circulating around some of the medication safety forums with a question related to the administration and provision of that. It appears to be an injection or a rapid bolus followed by an infusion. And for the emergency department, when it comes to drug preparation, many times there's a balancing act between what the staff in the pharmacy are going to do with respect to compounding and delivering versus what staff in the emergency department are going to do with respect to reconstitution or preparation and administration. So where have you found the sweet spot, so to speak, for delivering a critical therapy like that?
Well, I can speak to that. In Clarity, I do some educational consulting and speaking for the company that produces Andexa. I became involved with them because of my interest in looking at DOAC toxicity as another acute cardiovascular emergency. So I can speak to the science, but I just want to be upfront that I do some educational speaking for them as well. But when you have somebody with a life-threatening bleed and they're determined to be on an anticoagulant, then mitigation of that anticoagulant effect in becomes a second emergency for that treatment team. So if you come in with a head bleed, that's bad. But then if your INR comes back at 11 and you're on Coumadin, now I have to treat your head bleed and I have to treat your anticoagulation, which is no longer beneficial. One of the things with DOACT is now, because we do have this agent that can be kept in the ER and mixed up very quickly and given without too many complications, it now offers us an antidote to DOACT toxicity that parallels what we have now with Coumadin, where you have like four-factor and vitamin K and FFP and so forth. So that idea of having a treatment that is available when your medicine is no longer beneficial is important as more and more people go on DOACs and are starting to come to the ER with emergency bleeds.
So in terms of the preparation, do you find a split between pharmacy prepared with delivery versus having it on hand in the emergency department? Have you found one way that works better than another, or some conditions, preconditions that need to be met in order for that to be really successful?
For the administration of a MACE agent in anticoagulation emergency. So in other words, if someone comes in and we need to do emergency coagulant reversal, that's your question, correct?
Yes.
Yes. Well, then I think the idea, just like in STEMI, where time is muscle, in the brain, where an intracranial bleed is like a compartment syndrome, it's swelling up with nowhere to go, then time from diagnosis on CT scan to administration of your antidote is important, which then suggests that these emergency antidotes to be most effective should be in the emergency departments so that they can be accessed as close as possible to the time of diagnosis. Because if a head bleed expands, then it's too late for us to prevent expansion. So the thought is these emergency antidotes should be in the emergency department.
No, it's very similar to our thrombolytics that we have.
Exactly. It's like one ER doc said, she said it's a mix of thrombolytics and Crofab. She works out in West Texas, and she said, when I get a big diamondback bite, I know I start mixing Crofab vials, and every time it hits the ground, that's a really expensive thing, but that's what the patient needs.
Yeah.
And so very similar. It's a great question. Is in emergency anticoagulation emergencies, the antidote should be there quickly.
Yeah, well, there's some systemic factors that are driving that question, because the breadth of staff that would require training for a relatively rare event is much larger in the emergency department. It's much smaller and more manageable in a pharmacy department. And so from a variability perspective and a consistency perspective, there are arguments to be made that from a safety perspective and high reliability, to have that done in pharmacy and delivered as opposed to in an emergency department and then reconstituted and prepared. But at the same time, I'll fully acknowledge that we have things like thrombolytics in there, that it's very capable, it's very possible to have staff that are competent and trained in this. And it may be a function of scale with respect to how often it's required for these patients.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, if you had grandma gone bad and she got put on a DOAC and then she fell and bonked her head and had an intracranial hemorrhage, and she's on her DOAC, so she's that double positive that needs an antidote, then fortunately, these agents are very easy to mix and administer because they don't have any hemodynamic issues or compatibility issues or IV intermedication administration issues. They're designed to be, you know, rolled and mixed but not shaken, and there's a very defined dose. It's either 5 or 9 vials. And so the administration cycle is very efficient, provided that the system does a bit of training. Yeah. But the biggest bang for DOACs is understanding the risk management of people being discharged on them, like this lady.
Yeah, So let's go back to that case. So this lady comes in. She's had her swollen calf. They've done the ultrasound and diagnosed a deep vein thrombosis. They put her on a DOAC, and they say, this is really important. You take it every day and go home. And as you noted, after the first month, then she's getting hit with a bill. So how is that, from a patient experience, a surprise? Are they getting samples? Are they getting a discount prescription to begin with? What's causing that steep rise in the cost for the patient's experience?
Well, I always use my baseline as what I call the COB cost, cash on the barrelhead. I have no insurance. I walk to a pharmacy. Now it's a little easier with goodrx.com, which I'm sure everyone out there is super familiar with. And the price that the patient with no insurance has to pay before screening, that's the cash on the barrelhead price. And everyone should be aware that the COB price for any of these non-generic DOACs is several hundred dollars each month. And many insurance companies might cover one of these, but not the others. And so if the patient shows up and they've been placed on Eliquis, but their insurance plan doesn't cover that, then that is their surprise when they go see their PCP. But now they're stuck because they need their next month's medicine, but now they either need a prescription for something equivalent, they fork over the money, or they don't take it. So that there is a big hurdle that this lady went through, because she was fortunately given a 30-day in-hand bottle from the emergency department that sent her home. She did call her primary care doctor, but then it wasn't until I had her call her insurance company that she found out that her insurance actually wouldn't cover this. So then I had her call the company to see if they could help her, and they referred her to Social Security, which never did call her back that next month. But then she also followed up with a rural healthcare program in the area that could give her some assistance. So she was calling them to see what DOACs they actually covered. So if they didn't cover the one she was on, maybe her PCP could write for an equivalent. And then I said, well, you know, if you can't afford any of these, did you tell your PCP that you can't afford them? Because maybe they can put you on warfarin, which is cheap for you, right? Out of pocket expense. And so in the end, she kept on her second month because a friend of hers a month of Eliquis laying around that she had. And so she got somebody else's prescription to continue her second month. And then she was going to talk to her PCP about her third month. And then I asked her, well, how long did they tell you in the ER that you might need to be on this medicine? And she said, well, they said I need to be on it at least 3 months. And then my primary care doctor will help me figure out where I go from there. But because her primary care doctor was going to be on 2 weeks vacation during the 3 month anniversary of the decision, she was now trying to email her primary care doctor to see if they were even going to want her to stay on it past 3 months, because each month was costing her $500+.
That's crazy.
Now, this is routine. Now, the other thing was, this lady was elderly. She'd had prior back surgery. She'd had falls. And she lived in a place with poor lighting, and she lived in the mountains. Yet they discharged her home with no what I call fall assessment screen done that I could get out of her. They gave her no fall precautions at home. Fortunately, the doctor, she did follow the doctor who said, and it wasn't written anywhere, you should get a walking stick and take it wherever you go. And I was actually surprised, because I met her at the restaurant where we started to talk, and she actually had a trekking stick with her. So the one thing that they did in the ER was they talked to her about getting a stick, which is of paramount importance in old people to prevent, and any person, so they don't fall. So there's ways that you could have looked at this visit and said, did somebody in the emergency department send a visit note or call the on-call doctor for the primary care physician she was supposed to see? That would be really important. Number two is, there's all kinds of fall assessment tools, FAT tools, I call them FATs. And where I worked in an academic center, we got caught up in whether or not this would be part of the medical record, right? So we went to 10 different places and copied all of their fall assessment screenings and came up with 20 questions that the clinician could ask the patient to assess their fall risk, but it wasn't part of the quote official medical record. So we didn't have to go through the forms committee, right? And then we separated and said, if the patient has an occlusive clot, we understand that some of those folks, if they don't recanalize, they need to get intravenous TPA for recanalization therapy. And if that's not done early, you lose the chance and some of those folks will have post-occlusive problems. So there's follow-up for the patient, that's their PCP. If they have an occlusive clot or a problem clot, they also need to get plugged into somebody like vascular medicine who can look at the clot, maybe re-ultrasound it, and see if it's opened up, because if it hasn't, maybe she needs some TPA in her leg. So this lady didn't know if she had an occlusive clot. She didn't understand primary care follow-up. She had no vascular medicine follow-up. She didn't know about fall risk. She wasn't made aware of the cost of this medicine. No one asked her, have you fallen lately or are you on any sedating medicines, which she was. So there was all types of opportunities for systematic approach that were completely missed with her.
Well, that's the end of part one, but don't worry, we're going to continue the case of Grandma Gone Bad in part two and get into some really interesting discussions surrounding some of the things that clinicians can work with, the tools that we have within institutions to really help create safer systems. So once again, thank you for your attention, thank you for your time. And thank you most of all for what you do for our patients, for those little details, the communication to the primary care physicians, to the lab, getting labs done on time, for the patient education, for patiently explaining to patients what they need to understand so that they can take their medications safely. Really appreciate all that you do and hope that you were able to gain some benefit, gain some ideas so that we can all do better at caring safely.